Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Exoplanets are planets beyond our solar system. Thousands of them have been discovered in the past two decades, and the pace of discovery is snowballing. Astrophysicist Angie Wolfgang is a National Science Foundation postdoctoral fellow at Penn State and an avid planet hunter. She talked with WPSU's Christine Allen about how to find exoplanets and about a recent discovery that has scientists swooning.
Dr. Angie Wolfgang, welcome to Take Note.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
How do scientists search for exoplanets?
We have spent a lot of time figuring this out. Because it's hard. There are a number of ways to find exoplanets. The two main ones that have produced the largest number of discoveries to date are the wobble method and the transit method. So for both of these methods, we stare at the star. We look at the light from the star, and based on what the star is doing, we infer the presence of a planet. So the wobble method looks at the motion of the star. When the planet orbits around the star actually moves as well. It looks kind of like a top wobbling a little bit.
Right, that's from a little bit of gravitational effect that the planet has on the star.
Exactly.
You can actually detect that.
Yes. So as the technology has gotten better and better, we're able to see smaller and smaller wobbles, which corresponds to less and less massive planets. So we've gone from detecting really massive planets, more massive than Jupiter, all the way down to Earth-sized planets now. So the transit method is where we stare at light coming from the star and the planet passes in front of it from our vantage point. And so if we're staring at the star for a long time, then we can actually see light being blocked out by the planet. This is the planet detection method that the Kepler Space Telescope used, which is where a lot of the data that I research comes from. And what the Kepler mission did was stare at hundreds of thousands of stars all at once, trying to find these little, really tiny dips in the brightness coming from the star, which is a signal of something crossing in front of the star.
You look at those dips, and from what I understand, if they recur at regular intervals, then you've got, an orbit?
Yeah, you've got something that is passing in front of the star periodically. So you can have a star also passing in front of a star periodically. So one of the biggest kind of things that we have to work on is to figure out which of these dips are due to stars versus which are due to planets. We have a whole bunch of techniques that we can use in order to distinguish between these two scenarios. So once we've narrowed down the possibilities to just planets, we have a high confidence and we can characterize the planet's properties.
Is there more information you can get from those dips in light besides just how long the orbit of this body in front of the star is?
Yeah, so the depth of the dip corresponds to the size of the object that was blocking out the light. So the smaller the dip, the smaller the body. And so stars are much larger than planets. So for very large dips, we have a good suspicion that it's a star. And for smaller dips, our confidence is higher that it's actually a planet.
So you mentioned the Kepler telescope. That is a space telescope. It was launched into orbit, I think, in 2009.
Yep.
And I understand that there was a problem with the telescope, which was actually fortunate. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do know what you're talking about. So Kepler is astounding. It's able to measure the brightness of these stars to very, very high precision, very precisely. And that's one of the things that they had to demonstrate they were able to do before the mission was even going to be launched. So just to give you a little bit of a sense for how small these signals are, an Earth-sized planet that's orbiting a sun-sized star has a dip of 0.01%.
Wow.
Yeah. So this telescope has to point very precisely. And one of the ways that it's able to do this is it has these things called reaction wheels as part of the engineering of the telescope that is able to stabilize it in space to point at this one area of space really, really precisely. Unfortunately, in 2013, two of the reaction wheels failed. And so it was no longer able to point really precisely at this one point of sky that it had already been staring at for 4 years. So all the NASA scientists and engineers kind of were scrambling in order to figure out what to do with this amazingly precise instrument that if it wasn't for this reaction wheel, would do amazingly well. Well, so they weighed all the different options and ingeniously came up with a way to stabilize the spacecraft. It was actually, turns out, stabilized by the pressure from our sun. And so because of this, Kepler has to point in this area called the ecliptic, which is basically the plane of Earth's orbit. And that this has turned out to be actually a great thing, because we're forced to look at a different area of the sky. We've been able to observe so many different kinds of stars, and not just stars, but all kinds of objects in space. There's people who study galaxies, the center, the nuclei of galaxies, who have used Kepler before. And so it's turned out to be a really great thing for all of the science that it has produced.
When we're looking for exoplanets, when you're looking for them, what characteristics are you hoping to find or really looking out for, and why?
Right now, a lot of our characterization of these planets has to do with getting measurements of their mass, measurements of their radius, measurements of their orbital period. So those are the three basic things that we're kind of looking for. And actually, which of those three we can detect depends on what method we're using to find them. Also, we can sometimes get a sense for the shape of the orbit. So sometimes the shape of the orbit is oblong, like an ellipse. And so we can measure how elliptical that orbit is. And that is actually a really interesting piece of information as well, because that gets at how these planets formed, how their orbits might have evolved, how they've moved through and around their stars in the past. So there's a lot of different things that we're looking for. To go back to the mass and radius, these two things are really what we need to measure in order to get a sense of what the planet's made of its composition. So, of course, the mass and the radius also get us a sense for how small or how large the planet is. One of the things that we're really excited about looking for is the smaller and smaller planets that we can find with it. This is, of course, one of the big things that makes all the press releases is finding the next smallest planet, or the one that is most like Earth in these three kind of the mass, radius, and orbital period that we can currently measure.
So what a lot of us are hoping for is, can we find a planet that could harbor life of some kind? And I guess a smaller planet is more likely. Why is that?
This is important to give context to our search. So in our solar system, we have terrestrial planets and we have gas giant planets. And the terrestrial planets, so terrestrial meaning they're made primarily of rocky material and iron material, they tend to be much smaller than the gas giants, as you can guess by the name. And so from this, we already had a suspicion that we really wanted to find as small planets as we can possibly find, just based on our own solar system. The surprising thing that we have found is that there's this entire intermediate class of planets that does not exist in our own solar system. And this is the super-Earths. And the reason why they're called super-Earths is because they're slightly larger and more massive than Earth. But the interesting thing about these also is that their compositions seem also to be at least slightly different. So they have more gas. They have more gas around this kind of like rocky iron core than the terrestrial planets in our own solar system. And so that's really puzzling. As to your question of, you know, why would we look to smaller planets to have things that are more like Earth? You know, it was kind of challenging to figure out at what size planets could actually be and would be rocky. We're still actually kind of trying to figure that out, but the way that we're going about this search is to start from what we understand based on our own solar system. And what we understand is that smaller planets are more likely to be rocky and Earth-like.
And the location of the planet relative to its star is very important as well.
Yes.
There's something called the Goldilocks zone. What is that?
Yeah, so that is defined as the distance away from the star where liquid water could exist on the surface of the planet. It's Goldilocks because the planet's not too hot. So if it was closer in, it would be really kind of blasted by the light from the star. And it would get really, really hot. Too far away, and it's too cold. It doesn't get enough light from the star. So this Goldilocks zone is right where you need to have liquid water on the surface.
Liquid water makes the life, at least the type of life that we know about, carbon-based life, possible. It gives a possibility, right?
Right. Yeah. So you make a good point here that even when a planet is found to be in the Goldilocks zone or the habitable zone, that doesn't mean that it's actually habitable. It just means that it satisfies the criteria that we have imposed so far.
Right.
And understand it to be necessary requirements for being habitable.
So you mentioned that there are planets out there. There's something between Mars and Jupiter, something rocky but with more gas, and
yeah.
that we don't have a planet like that in our solar system. Is it possible that there are other types of planets altogether that we are not familiar with?
Great question. And, you know, this is one of the things that kind of drives a lot of people to study exoplanets and to do this research, is finding things that we completely did not expect before. So based on what we have found in the past, we've been surprised over and over and over again about the kinds of exoplanets that exist. And so it doesn't seem too unreasonable to me that we would find something else that was completely surprising. So it's just up to our imaginations in order to think about what that could be.
I've heard that water worlds is a possibility, a world covered by an ocean, no land, right?
Yeah, yeah. So that's definitely something that people are modeling and are considering as possibilities. There's all kinds of different things that go into this. And part of it also is how these planets could have formed with that much water. And so we're trying to figure out what the most likely scenarios are. But yeah, this is something that we're actively researching now.
You're listening to Take Note. I'm Christine Allen, speaking with Dr. Angie Wolfgang, a National Science Foundation postdoctoral fellow in the Department of Astronomy and Astrophysics at Penn State University. Dr. Wolfgang studies a special class of exoplanets called super-Earths. There was an amazing exoplanet discovery announced in February of 2017, the TRAPPIST system. What was so special about this system of planets around a star called TRAPPIST-1, which I guess was named for a telescope in Chile where it was first spotted?
Yeah. This system was exciting for several reasons, actually. First of all, the discovery was seven planets orbiting a very, very, very low mass star. The star is actually extreme in the fact that it's so small. It's almost not a star.
It's a red dwarf, right?
Yeah, it's a red dwarf. And so the less mass of the star, the harder it is for it to burn, fuse hydrogen in its core. And that's really where the energy for these stars come from. And so there's a boundary in mass between red dwarfs, which are the smallest, coolest stars, and brown dwarfs, which are not quite massive enough to burn regular hydrogen in its core. And the star is right at the boundary. And so that's kind of interesting to begin with. Second, there were seven planets discovered. Before this system, there had not been that many planets discovered around such a small star. So that was also very interesting. And then on top of that, there were three of those planets were in this Goldilocks zone that we were talking about before. And that is the most planets that exist in this zone that we've discovered so far. So this system is extraordinary for a number of different reasons.
And those planets, I'm not sure if all of them, but some of them at least are tidally locked. What is that and what does that mean?
Yeah, so that means that one face of the planet is always facing the star. It's kind of like the moon. One face of the moon is always pointing towards Earth. And so that's what's happening with these planets to their star.
So one side would always be very cold and the other side would be very warm.
Yes.
Right. I've heard scientists say that if there were life of some sort developing, it would probably be in that twilight zone where it's always twilight between the dark side and the light side.
Yeah. Talk about a literal twilight zone.
Yeah.
That would be really interesting.
And it would be a reddish twilight because the light from that star is more reddish.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, so the main wavelength that stars emit is related to their mass and their temperature. So this red dwarf star is really cool, and it emits at longer wavelengths, red wavelengths.
I've seen artist depictions of TRAPPIST system. In an artist depiction of what it might be like on one of those planets, you also would see very large planets in the daytime because they're closer together, huddling for warmth around that very cool star. I also understand there's been an Scientists believe they've discovered an atmosphere, detected an atmosphere, signs of an atmosphere on an Earth-sized exoplanet. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, that exoplanet is called Gliese 1132b. All of these exoplanets
have...
Typical planet name. Yeah. So this is another planet that is around a cool star. It's not quite as cool as TRAPPIST-1, but it still is classified as a red dwarf. So it's much, much smaller and cooler than our sun. And so this planet is 12 parsecs away, which is astronomers' units of distance. It's less than 40 light years away. So because this system is so close to us, it's easier to go back and observe that system again and again and get additional data. And so one of the key things that as a community we're really interested in figuring out is, first of all, do these planets have an atmosphere? And second of all, what is that atmosphere made of? And you really need planets that and stars, both of them, that are close to us in order to be able to get the data we need to answer those questions. So one such group did exactly this. They went back to the system and observed it with a spectrograph that was able to split up light into different wavelengths. And so we were talking about the transit method before. Mm-hmm. So they used this. They observed the signature, this dip in light, but as a function at different wavelengths. And so if the planet has an atmosphere, then that the depth of that dip that you see will change from wavelength to wavelength. And so they measured a tentative change in that depth as a function of wavelength. And so that's what they were reporting, was this change. And so part of what we do as astronomers is also build models to explain the data. And so they fit a couple models to it and found that there was one wavelength where the depth was a little bit bigger than the rest. And so they fit a model and saw that there needed to be gas to it.
So that gas would be reflecting that color of light, or absorbing, I'm sorry. The gas would be absorbing one particular color of light and giving off that signature for you. Let's talk about the future of exploring exoplanets. There's a new telescope that's being launched in 2018, the James Webb Space Telescope. Can you tell us what that would be able to do that we can't do already?
Yeah, okay. So I have to say, I actually was just at NASA Goddard. I'm going to gush a little bit.
Okay.
Because I was just at NASA Goddard and got the amazing privilege to actually see James Webb as it was being packaged up to ship for further testing. And they had, this telescope is, it's enormous. It's way bigger than anything that astronomers have sent to space for an optical telescope before. It's so big that they have to fold the mirror up in order to put it in the rocket in order to send it up into space. So they actually had it tilted up, and you could see this mirror is 6 meters in diameter. It's enormous, and they had it tilted up, and so you could actually see yourself in the reflection. It's like this gold surface. Oh, man, it was amazing. So just like the telescope itself is cool, but the science, which is what you asked about, mm-hmm. is also really exciting. Because the mirror is so big, we can see fainter things than we were able to see before in space. So one of the advantages of going to space in general is that you don't have to deal with the atmosphere. And so what that means is that you can actually resolve smaller features in the objects that you're looking at. But the issue as well is, you know, you need a larger surface to kind of like serve as like a bucket for these photons. And so the larger your bucket, the more photons you can collect, and the fainter the objects that you can see. And so it's going to be used a lot for galaxies that were formed very, very early on in the universe. For exoplanets, it will be used to do this kind of atmospheric measurement that we were just talking about. These measurements are really, really hard. And the more light that you can collect, the stronger the signal that you will get and the easier it is to detect certain molecules. So that's one of the most exciting things that James Webb will do for exoplanet science, is measure more atmospheres.
Right. So I know it has a big mirror, but what does it need to detect particular elements in an atmosphere so we know what atmospheres are made of in exoplanets?
Right. So I mentioned this before, that it needs a spectrometer. So what a spectrometer does is it takes light and then it spreads it out at different wavelengths. So it basically, you can think of it like a prism, that it creates a rainbow. And so what astronomers do is we put a camera where that rainbow is kind of projected onto, and that allows us to measure how bright the light is at those different wavelengths that were spread out. And so in order to be able to do any kind of atmospheric characterization like this, you need the ability to spread out light of different wavelengths. And so that's absolutely what it needs. And so it doesn't just have one spectrometer, it has a lot of different instruments that are optimized for the optical wavelengths, which is what we see in, or the infrared wavelengths, which is what we kind of perceive heat as, or even longer wavelengths.
So do you think we're actually going to be able to perhaps detect specific things like water, methane, oxygen in exoplanet atmospheres with James Webb Telescope?
Yeah. So we already have preliminary detections of water and definitely methane and carbon dioxide and those kind of things in larger exoplanets. So really what we want to be able to do with James Webb and the capability that it will give us is to push this to smaller planets, to those that are more like Earth. And again, this is getting one step closer to trying to figure out which of these planets are actually habitable.
I want to ask you just a little bit about the Center for Exoplanets at Penn State. It's within the Department of Astronomy and Astrophysics in the Eberly College of Science at Penn State. Tell me what that center does and who's involved.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of people involved. It's basically a group of faculty and postdocs and grad students. We all study exoplanet science. So we have Suvrath Mahadevan is the PI of a couple of these spectrographs that I was explaining. Him and his group are building these. There's also people working on kind of like the theory of planet formation. So Professor Becky Dawson and Professor Eric Ford. And then also people working on planet detection. So Professor Jason Wright, for example. And we also have people working on brown dwarfs, Kevin Luman, and other parts of theory. So it's a very rich kind of exchange of ideas. It's very exciting to be there.
And I understand it's really interdisciplinary, that there are scientists in other fields working on aspects. Engineering, perhaps?
Yeah, so we actually have a seminar every Monday talking about different topics in exoplanet science. And we have people from geology and geophysics come over and just like exchange ideas. So exoplanets is definitely kind of interdisciplinary between planetary science and like geology, atmospheric science, and astronomy. So there's a lot of crosstalk there.
When did you first become interested in astronomy?
Yeah. So everyone asks me this, and I think it's just one of those things where I've definitely always been interested in space. I totally read sci-fi as a kid. And when I got to high school and took physics for the first time, I was like, I actually really, really like physics, because it explains the world. And that's always what has driven me, is to try to understand what's going on in the world around me. So astrophysics was kind of like the perfect combination of those two interests. So if you ask my mom, she first became aware that I wanted to become an astronomer during some gathering, and we were asked like what we wanted to be when we grew up, and I said an astronomer. I don't remember this, but she said that this was the first time that she heard about it.
So pretty much a lifelong ambition.
Yeah.
What is your work like day to day? What's a day in the life of a planet hunter like?
Yeah, so it really varies. I personally travel a lot, which I really like. So I get to go to different places and talk to different people about projects, work on different things. When I'm here, my specific work, I do a lot of statistical modeling as part of my work. This involves a lot of coding, being in front of my computer, but a big part of being a scientist as well is going to talks, engaging with different people, asking people questions, because those questions is what drives the forefront of our knowledge, right? So if you have a like interesting idea, or you don't quite understand what someone else is talking about, and you engage in that conversation, that can actually produce some really interesting science. So that's also a big part of my job as well.
The nearest known exoplanets are still many light years away, much too far to travel in a human lifetime. So it seems kind of bittersweet to me that even if we detect conditions very conducive to life on an exoplanet, we'll never really know, will we? And we'll never be able to make contact if we do know.
I guess those are two different questions. So, yeah, it's going to be very difficult to definitively say, you know, this planet is definitely habitable, let alone this planet definitely has life. Honestly, this is part of what is driving our research. We're trying to figure out what that looks like from our vantage point pretty far away. And so that it's going to take a lot of many more years of research to be able to figure that out. But one of the things that got me interested in exoplanets to begin with, even though we're definitely, you and me, we're not going to be able to travel to a different exoplanet. I don't know, maybe thousands of years in the future, humanity will be able to make it there. And, you know, that's a really long-term view on this, but it's one that is definitely motivating me. So,
an idea that was put forth recently to sort of cut through that great distance was the idea of a space chip. Do you know how those would work?
Yeah.
A space chip, I didn't say space ship, but a space chip. The idea that something large can't go fast enough to get anywhere near to even Proxima Centauri, where this, the nearest mm-hmm. exoplanet
right.
is around
which
the
is
star.
Which is 4 light years away.
Right.
It takes light itself 4 years to get there.
Right, and we can't go anywhere near light, so it would take like a craft like New Horizons took 9.5 years to get to Pluto. It would take about 54,000 years for New Horizons to get to Proxima Centauri. With a space chip, though, can you explain what that is?
Yeah, so you try to get something as small as possible that can still send signals back to Earth. You kind of attach it to this sail, and then you bombard the sail with laser light in order to be able to accelerate this super tiny thing that you've launched into space close to the speed of light. And the idea is not just to do one of these, but to do thousands of them and to send them towards Proxima Centauri. So this is the breakthrough initiative that we're talking about. You know, there's a lot of technological details that still have to be worked
right.
out. So it's amusing that you ask, how does this work? That's part of our job.
It doesn't work yet. right. But what kinds of information would these space chips be able to send back to us?
There's a kind of a sweet spot between how large the nanosatellite can be and how small it has to be in order to go fast enough, right? And you need a slightly larger satellite in order to be able to have more onboard electronics in order to send more information back. So there's a trade-off between the speed at which it can go and how much information it can send. So this is part of the trade-off that people are trying to figure out right now.
I should mention that there's something called the Breakthrough Prize Foundation that announced this idea in August of 2016, and that people are working on making this happen in the future. We don't know how it will work yet, but it's an exciting idea.
Right.
Scientists now believe that, correct me if I'm wrong, but scientists now believe that most of the stars we can see have planets around them.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And as Carl Sagan would say, that means billions and billions of chances for some kind of life to develop. Do you think that there's life out there?
Yeah, okay. So I love answering this question, but in order to answer this question, I tell people I have to take off my scientist hat and mm-hmm. just, you know, share this as, you know, not a scientist. Because
right.
honestly, we don't have any evidence right now that there is life. But given how many planets we have discovered, I think it would be very arrogant for us to think that we're the only ones out there. That's the way that I kind of like to think about it. I have hope.
Angie Wolfgang, thank you so much and happy exoplanet hunting.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was WPSU's Christine Allen talking with planet hunter Angie Wolfgang, a National Science Foundation postdoctoral fellow in Penn State's Department of Astronomy and Astrophysics. You'll find links to more information about exoplanets and the TRAPPIST-D system on our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.